All right, good. It's working. And we are recording.
Recording in progress.
Tuesday, March 7th, 2023 at 3:14 p.m. Eastern time. Claire and I just became mortal blood enemies. I was telling her about how great my parents' sauna is, and she said it would sound awful. And I said, it feels like a 9-hour massage. And she said, that would also sound awful. So there is now a great schism between me and Claire. We are no longer friends. That's all a lie.
We'll get over it. We'll manage.
We will make amends. With that, Miss Lopez, and again, everybody go to the description, go to their websites, Twitter, readings, all that good stuff, or writings. What I did want to ask you about is we threw out some topics the other day. I think two would kind of be cool to cover today because they kind of blend in together. And it's Russia, neo-empirical ambitions, as well as I think in the last week, and I think I have the term correct, is a Russian-China, quote, military technical alliance. I don't know if that's the exact term, but it was some weird cryptic euphemism term that I saw over the weekend. Could you maybe expand on either of those, neo-empirical or the Russia-China?
Yeah, so let's begin with the first one. The first thing to understand, I think, is that neither China nor Russia today is a country. Each of them is, in fact, an empire of conquered people, conquered over centuries of warfare. They're not, uni-ethnic people. You can say that, countries in Europe like Italy and France and Britain were made up of, various principalities in centuries past. But they eventually joined together, and you can say now the Italians are one people, right? Well, the Chinese are not. The Chinese are Manchus and Mongols and Cantonese and Uyghurs and Tibetans, and they're very different people ethnically, linguistically, and every other way. And the same goes for Russia, too. So to call each of those, a neo-empirical power today is simply to acknowledge how they got to where they are today, to be what they are, and to acknowledge that they continue in the current century on the pathway of centuries past to seek to enlarge their empires. It's quite simple, really. So to Russia specifically, in the past, of course, been much larger as a Russian empire, as a Soviet Union. The current ruler in the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, of course, is famous for having said that the worst disaster of his lifetime was the dissolution of the Soviet Union back in 1991. And he's repeated in many places and times, writing and in speeches, that he intends to do everything possible in his lifetime to reassemble the Soviet Union, or at least those parts of it that were under its power and influence, if not the Russian Empire itself. And he's also said multiple times that he does not consider national sovereignty to be a legitimate defense against conquest, essentially. And that the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian nation, has no right to exist as an independent nation state, despite, of course, the fact that it is a full-fledged member of the United Nations, that it has established certain sovereign national borders per the Westphalian Treaty of 1648. But Ukraine, like Moldova now, keep an eye on that place, has a sliver of its eastern territory that the Russians previously have invaded, and in which the Russians have sought to stir up separatist sentiments. For Moldova, it's the Transnistria region, and of course in Ukraine, it's the Donbas, the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, which Russia claims for its own just because it wants to. I mean, it has no right to them. It has no claim to national sovereignty over the Donbass, but says, well, there are ethnic Russians there who speak Russian, so we ought to be able to just march in and take it. And, you know, in some exchanges I've had on social media, I've said, well, you know, what if the Chinese were to invade the United States in the near future and slice off, you know, Oregon, Washington State, California, and, you know, then claim that for its own. And then some other country decides to step in and negotiate on our behalf, the United States' behalf with China, about that the Western states, about our West Coast, and, you know, come to the conclusion that, you know, we ought to just give up the West Coast. I mean, maybe some of us wouldn't mind letting some of that go, but nevertheless, stay with me here. That we should just allow the West Coast to go to China and then try to reassure Idaho and Montana and, I don't know, Nevada and Utah and Arizona that they're going to be just fine. Just, you know, calm down. It's all good. You'll be fine. Would that make sense to anybody? But it doesn't to me. So that's neo-imperialism as I see it, in particular about Russia, also China. So...
it kind of is a, I was going to say sad, but I suppose it is emotionless. It's neutral. It kind of pays tribute to power comes from the barrel of a gun.
That's what Mao said, didn't he?
He did.
And you got a second part to your opening there that you were asking me.
The Chinese, Russia military the technical
Russian,
lines?
Oh, Axis or Alliance or whatever. Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to next.
I'll Google it right now as you're talking so I get the term correct.
Okay. Well, I mean, in any case, we know that back in 2022, before the Russians launched their invasion of Ukraine, the Russians and the Chinese, Putin and Xi Jinping, the ruler of China, issued a joint statement that, you know, they were BFFs forever. And what we've seen since then is not quite maybe all the hoopla was billed to be at the time then in early February of 2022. Back up, we were just mentioning Mao, back up to Mao's takeover of China in 1949. And at that time, China was a backward country, poverty-stricken, hit repeatedly over, well, the centuries by famines. People faced starvation on a regular basis, not technologically advanced or developed, economy in shambles, all of that. And Russia at that time was more advanced in each of those areas that we've mentioned. But since then, it's been a complete flip. And today, even though both Russia and China face a demographic death spiral, because in Russia's case, they have more abortions than children born alive. And in China, the decades of the one-child policy and the female infanticide and selective abortions of female babies left China without women, essentially. And today there are something like 30 or 40 million Chinese young men who cannot find a wife, who will never have children or a family. And they call them bare branches for that reason. It is said by some who calculate these kinds of demographics that China will have a population roughly around equal to that of the United States by the end of this, the 21st century. Imagine that. They're supposedly at 1.4 billion today, maybe. So despite China and Russia both in a demographic death spiral, as I said there, the roles have switched places. Today, China is elder brother. Russia is younger brother. China is far more technologically advanced. I've heard Russia described as a gas station with nukes. It's a bit flippant, and perhaps overstates the case, but Russia does not have the dynamism, the technological development, obviously doesn't have the military that it once had or was cracked up to have during, let's say, the Cold War years. But China does. And so this alliance between them, whatever it amounts to, is an unequal one. And so far, as China has been quite cautious, I think, kind of standing off, expressing support for Putin and for Russia, but not really diving in, you know, with all the support. Yes, there have been financial arrangements behind the scenes for payment, mutual payments, rubles rubles, the Russians and
yen, yuan.
Yeah, yuan for the Chinese. So that helps out with their economic situation, perhaps. Russia provides China with petroleum products, oil, which China does not have much of in abundance. But it's China that's producing the technological goods, whether those be consumer goods or military. And China has not offered yet to provide, all kinds of military assistance to Russia. Supposedly, that decision is under consideration now. Don't know if there's going to be a decision, coming late soon or not, about providing lethal military aid to Russia for use in Ukraine. But at the moment, they're not. They've provided other things, yes, like the financial arrangements, like maybe intelligence, that sort of thing. But not the lethal military aid that Russia is burning through at a rate that is not sustainable. So I guess the bottom line on all of this is that China, like the rest of the world, is watching what's going on between Russia and Ukraine, watching the Western world, Western Europe, NATO, United States, come together in a way we perhaps didn't think would happen, back in 2022 and before, in such a situation, but coming together to support Ukraine, not just because it is the one that's been invaded, bombed to smithereens, population, decimated, its hospitals, clinics, kindergartens, and apartment buildings smashed with missiles, not just because they are the ones invaded, Russia doing the illegal invasion across national sovereign territorial lines, but also I think there is, and I hope this is true anyway, but the understanding of the recognition that what's at stake here, we're not talking about defending democracy or freedom in Ukraine. I mean, that would be great if that's part of the outcome, yes. And nobody is going to ever say that the leadership of Ukraine is a bunch of choir boys. They're not. But what's being defended, and I hope this is the understanding, is that the Westphalian nation-state system, which is an ideal, often as not honored in the breach, but the ideal of a sovereign nation-state with inviolable borders, ideally again, that's the principle of the world order that I think the rest of us, want to defend for our children and grandchildren. And getting back to the first part of your question before, Russia and China are acting as neo-imperialist forces, back in centuries of time to the emperors and the warlords that rampaged across the landscape, with none to stand against them and defend the people, defend, the populations that were being overrun. But today we are, and I think that's a good thing. Now, I was just at CPAC, the conservative political action conference that's held annually. This one, this year, out at National Harbor in Maryland, just over the Potomac River from Virginia. 3 days of last week, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of March here, 2023. And there were a number of speakers there who did not follow, you know, the line of argument that I've just made. Steve Bannon, for example, just roared to the crowd. He had a lot of good things to say, and I like him very much. But on Ukraine, he couldn't dump them in the trash bin of history fast enough. It were up to him. And others like Tulsi Gabbard, same kind of thought process. Do not see that it's a broader ideal, you know, a broader concept that's being defended in Ukraine than just the nation state and the people of Ukraine, which deserve their nationhood, forging their nationhood in blood right now. They deserve that, but it's beyond that. What it goes to, again, back to what Putin has said so many times, is that he gets to decide who's allowed to be a sovereign nation state, who's allowed to be an independent people that makes their own decisions, you know, frames their own policies, domestic and foreign policies. He gets to decide because he declares that they're not a separate people. They belong to Russia. Well, the opposite of that argument is what I would say we are defending, and that is that the sovereign nation state system supersedes the globalist intentions of the neo-imperialists like Russia and China.
Do you think China is going to have... Well, I guess my question is answered if they're already meeting with Russia to discuss military aid. They've got to see that whatever happened to Russia would happen to them, right?
That's where I was going with that, exactly. And perhaps part of the reason why Xi Jinping has been cautious to date about going after Taiwan, which remains his objective, but, you know, he won his third term to party leadership of the Chinese Communist Party last October of 2022. And here we are now in March of 2023, and he has not yet made that move. I would suggest that at least part of his thought process and decision making on that is exactly watching how the Western world came together and has more or less mostly remained together in defense of Ukraine's right to independence. That cannot but be having an effect on Xi Jinping's thought process regarding Taiwan, I would think. Plus, the United States, to you know, credit where credit is due, the Biden administration has been strengthening ties with our East Asian partners and allies, like Japan, like South Korea, like the Philippines, of course, Taiwan. And it, you know, within the framework of organizations, of alliances, you know, like the Quad, as it's called, India, US, Japan, Australia, and others, AUKUS, AUKUS, US, UK, Australia, strengthening these alliances, beefing up defenses for Taiwan, beefing up military agreements and cooperation with the Philippines, another example. So Xi has certainly been watching all of this. I can't help but think that's, you know, feeding into his thought process. Yeah.
It just occurred to me then, do you think that BRICS will suffer a blow if China goes further in with Russia? And they kind of become a combined entity and thus are...
No, unfortunately, no, because, I mean, BRICS holds together for many reasons. Some of them are ideological. The basis, perhaps, is ideological. Economic reasons as well bind those countries together. Great big, victories like Lula da Silva's takeover of Brazil. By the way, Jair Bolsonaro, the former president of Brazil, brought the house down at CPAC, speaking through an interpreter, and with lots of video footage of his campaign for president. But these BRICS countries do hold together for many, many reasons. But primary among them probably is ideologically driven thinking that opposes a world order, indeed, based on sovereign nation states and the leadership of that, I would say, free world by the United States post-Cold War period. That holds them together. And so do other agreements, like the Sao Paulo Forum comes to mind since we're talking about Brazil, founded in Sao Paulo, Brazil, back in the 1990s, with Brazil as a leading founder of that organization, obviously. But they're to begin with bringing together the leftists, the communists, the Marxists, which Lula da Silva is a communist, a Marxist, together with Cuba, Mexico, and now look at a great big large part of Latin America has swung decidedly to the left, maybe not full on communist yet, but certainly in a socialist direction. So those kinds of things hold them together, I think. And I'm not sure that Russian aggression against Ukraine would diminish that glue that holds them together in BRICS.
Gotcha. Yeah, the only thing I was thinking is if China went all in with Russia and then suffered global sanctions and military resistance, would that force something like India or Brazil to, go, and kind of back out?
I could see something like that perhaps happening with regard to India, which is a very strong democracy, a democratic state, in a tough neighborhood to be sure. But I don't really see the others splintering apart. Maybe India could be peeled off, working with United States, working with Israel, and so forth, with enemies on its border, obviously Pakistan and China, but the others, maybe not so much.
Speaking of Israel, isn't Iran getting closer and closer to getting a nuclear weapon? Is Israel going to move on them?
Well, I mean, here's my take on it, and I think we might have touched on this before, but reading back to open source reporting, for example, from the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, which puts out a quarterly report from the Board of Governors about the Iranian nuclear weapons program, going as far back as November of 2011. This is the one report I keep bringing up and remembering because it was so very explicit, more so than any that I've seen before it or after it of these quarterly reports, describing the progress that at that time, 2011, okay, so that's 12 years ago, the progress that Iran was then making on the fashioning of nuclear warheads, fashioning, milling the uranium, that is enriched uranium, milling it into the hemispheres that fit together and the exchange between them of the electrons setting off the neutron or the nuclear implosion sequence, that sequence being started off by multiple implosion points impacting on the outside of the sphere of the two hemispheres. All that's described in the November 2011 IAEA report in quite a lot of detail, and talking there also about outside assistance to the Iranian nuclear weapons program, mentioning Russia, for example. And then you go ahead and you look at some of the documents that were revealed after the Mossad grabbed that heist of documents about the Iranian nuclear weapons program out of the warehouse located in or near downtown Tehran in January of 2016. And, you know, the later announcements from then and now again, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, about the contents of those documents, what's called the Ahmad plan for the development of nuclear warheads. Again, quite specific about the progress they'd been making and the objectives that they had. No question in mind, they were driving for a deliverable nuclear weapon. Many other revelations as well, but those two stand out for me. And, you know, and then you've got the steady drumbeat over the last couple of years of the Iranian regime announcing breathlessly, as the international media, I guess, hangs on every word, well, now we've passed 60%. Now we are enriching to 84%. I mean, they're playing with us. They're playing games with us. And the media and others fall for it. In my opinion, at least based on those earlier documents that we've talked about, earlier information that's been made public, I think that the Iranians have actually been building warheads for a number of years and testing them, probably in undeclared underground sites. I would suspect, I mean, in my opinion, again, that they probably have a small handful. By that, I mean 5, 6, 7, maybe. But there's an interesting fact that we have to understand, and that is that the IAEA and basically the international community does not recognize a nuclear weapon until that warhead is actually affixed to the nose cone of a delivery system, that is a missile. And I would think that that is probably the red line for Israel, that when Iran begins to attach whatever warheads it may have to its missiles, which we know very well they have many of because they've tested them openly for years, at that point, with or without the United States backing or even consultation or knowledge, Israel will have to defend itself. And anticipatory self-defense is enshrined in international law for centuries. So now with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu once again heading a coalition government in Jerusalem, I think everyone is just kind of on edge, waiting and watching to see what Israel will do, because it's very clear that the Biden administration here in the United States has no intention of stopping the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Quite to the contrary, in my opinion anyway, is that the Biden administration, by cravenly groveling on hands and knees to plead with the Iranian regime to re-engage on the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or nuclear accord with Iran, first agreed to in July of 2015, to revive that somehow, that is evidence to me that they're not serious about stopping the Iranian nuclear weapons program. And by the way, also at a time when reporting is coming out that there are Iranian hit squads, operatives on U.S. soil here in our country to assassinate former top U.S. officials like former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, like former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and very explicitly saying, well, we have the right to do this, says Tehran, because revenge for the January 2020 takedown of then Quds Force Commander Qasem Soleimani. So it doesn't seem to me that the Biden administration is the slightest bit serious about stopping an Iranian nuclear weapons program. Which the JCPOA, as has been said before, gives them basically a glide path to international recognition legitimacy for that program. And this is the program, this is the agreement that the Biden administration wants to revive, even while Iranian hit squads are on our soil gunning for our people, our top officials. So I think that sadly, in many ways, Israel stands alone right now. Not because Congress, not because the American people don't back them, we do, but that these particular officials in the Biden administration, many of which are retreads from the Obama administrations, like Antony Blinken at the State Department and Jake Sullivan at National Security Advisor, the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Israel, Thomas Nides, you know, they all, they would just, they would, in my opinion, again, I think they would like to see Iran go nuclear, and they have nothing but antipathy for the Jewish state of Israel or the current administration there of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Why is that? Is that anti-Semitism, or is that just this kind of bleeding heart, let's welcome Iran into the global arena? What's the,
you know,
core of it?
This goes back a ways, and I'll go back to the Obama administration again. Yes, it's anti-Semitism. I think so. But it's also this worldview, this Weltanschauung, if you will, that America is a force for ill in the world, a view held by these officials from Obama's administrations, now in the Biden administration too. America is a force for ill in the world, not for good. Therefore, anything that can be done to take it down a notch or two is to the good. And we'll remember, you know, how, you know, the Obama administration provoked the Islamic uprising across North Africa in 2010, 11, 12, deliberately sided with the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda militias to take down Ben Ali in Tunisia and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. Why? Because they sided with our enemies, with the Muslim Brotherhood, with Al-Qaeda. They wanted to see Islam rise in the world, and in particular, the region of Middle East, North Africa. And they wanted to see America and Western, they are Judeo-Christian principles diminished. This is their worldview. This is how they see the world. And now bring it forward, I think, again, my opinion, that they see Israel much as they view conservatives here in the United States, which is to say, bound to Judeo-Christian foundational principles of governance, and, you know, defenders of such principles as we find in our foundational documents, the Declaration of Independence, Constitution, Bill of Rights, which are individual liberty, equality of all in human dignity before the law, before the rule of man-made law. Ours, yes, based on Judeo-Christian principles, but nevertheless man-made law. You know, and these kinds of principles bind us and Israel together. And these are the things, unfortunately, that it seems to me that these who populated the Biden administration now in the Biden administration, and all too frequently populating the top levels of our media, certainly social media, you know, government, you know, other institutions like academia, populate and dominate those, but they're not the majority. But they do control levers of power because of their domination of those institutions. And we're seeing it right now as people are in the streets over in Israel protesting against the proposed reforms to the judicial system in Israel reforms that were part of Bibi Netanyahu's platform as he campaigned for prime minister last year, now presenting bills, packages of bills before the Knesset, the parliament, that would actually restore the balance of power between the executive branch in Israel and its judicial branch, the legislative branch, more specifically, and the judicial branch. Israel doesn't have a constitution. They're one of the few countries in the world that does not, and they have governed themselves mostly by the people's elected representatives in the Knesset, their parliament. Well, right now, and for the last couple of decades, the judiciary, the Supreme Court in particular in Israel, has seized, arrogated unto itself a tremendous amount of power, declaring itself the authority to override bills passed by the Knesset, to nominate and approve and appoint its own judges, indeed, even its own successors, with no input from the legislative branch, that is the Knesset, the people's elected representatives, and even claim the right to override decisions by the Israeli Department of Defense and the IDF, if you could imagine. Well, the packages of reforms that two-thirds of the Israeli people per polling support and want enacted are now being promoted in bills packages by the Netanyahu coalition government in the Knesset. But guess who is funding and supporting and backing the people in the street who want to bring down the Netanyahu coalition and destroy this, this set of proposed reforms to the judicial system? Well, it's the United States Department of State. Can you imagine? Again, I'm going back to this worldview, how Biden administration leadership views Israel and its leadership right now. And because the Israelis, of course, it's existential for them, oppose any revival of the JCPOA, that goes against Biden administration policy. And so Biden administration, in addition to its entire worldview of Israel in the first place, would like to help bring down the Bibi coalition, which really has just begun. But that in a nutshell, or maybe it's not such a, it's a very big nutshell, okay? that you know, the way I see it, the way that this administration and some of our leadership, across different institutions, sees Israel and sees it in the same way that they look down upon and mock with contempt, conservative American citizen patriots in this country.
Yeah, and Israel doesn't, they don't care. They're not going to wait around. They've shown in the past that they don't give a
no,
shit.
No, they're not
they're
waiting.
Gonna, they're going to go bomb them.
Yeah, there are, I think as I understand it, two packages of bills that have been proposed to the Knesset by the Netanyahu administration. And folks may or may not know this, but in the Israeli system, any bill to be enacted, to be enacted as law, has to pass three readings and three votes in the Knesset, spaced apart, maybe a week apart or maybe a little more apart, one, two, three. Well, these packages of judicial system reform bills so far have passed one reading and one vote of approval in the Knesset. There remain two readings, two votes to make them law. But yeah, they're pushing ahead with that. And the overwhelming numbers of approval in the Knesset for the first reading, I think, look ahead to similar votes for the remaining two that they have to do.
Yeah, it's going to, I mean, there is a very apparent, either we are a force for ill, I think more easily is it's just a form of self-hatred That seems to be the pervading theme in the entire, I guess, radical left is a form of self-hatred. It's never, I love this about me. It's, I hate this. I hate, and I understand that that's a very broad swath I'm painting it with, but yeah, that doesn't really surprise me. I guess the difference is Israel's not going to roll over. They don't care. It is existential. When the enemy is, I mean, no mince words, just, you know, death to Israel, exterminate the Jews. There's no reading between the lines. It's you or me. They're gonna go do it. They're gonna go drop some laser guided bombs. They're gonna send in the Mossad or Kidon. Like, they're not gonna wait, and nor should they. And yeah, good for them. You shouldn't wait on the U.S. to back you. Just go do it. Who cares?
But people, I really would like people to take note of the fact that the U.S. Department of State is actually backing, not with humongous amounts of money, but funding in any case, our U.S. taxpayer dollar funding for a group called the Movement for Quality Government, MQG. A bit of an awkward name, but nevertheless, they are the ones that are the front in Israel right now for promoting, funding, backing, enabling these protests in the streets. They're paying for the buses to get them to the rally points. They're paying for the banners and the placards and the signs they carry. They're paying for the stages and the sound setup where the speakers get up and rail against the Netanyahu reforms and so forth. They're paying for that. The Movement for Quality Government, which is funded in part by the United States Department of State, is paying for that. That to me is wrongful intervention in Israel's internal affairs. That we have no business doing that.
I think it's willful and apparent and purposeful anti-Semitism. It seems to be what it is. There's no, you know, you can paint it up so many times before it's like, yeah, no, this is anti-Semitism. It's what it is. Yeah. It's really no, again.
Yeah, I think so too.
Ms. Lopez, we got to wrap this one up. I have to make a call right after this, but thank you so much for doing this on short notice, and we'll resume our regularly scheduled programming as always. And guys, go into the description. Please follow Claire on Twitter. Just do that. Just follow Claire on Twitter. Stop hating yourselves. Love Israel. Don't just go follow Claire on Twitter. That's the takeaway from all of this. Just go follow Claire on Twitter. Ms. Lopez, thank you so much. Till next time. Take care, everybody.
You.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Tommy.
Take care, everybody. God bless.
Recording stopped.
Thank you for watching. Peace.